Okay, so I place your next homework also on the website. That's the one due next week, next Tuesday. And you want to see number 3 soon too. Is that it? All right, I understand. Okay, so that's where we were, right? Right here, we said that field is zero by symmetry, okay? Right. But the polarized equation is not giving us, and that's the distinction between the macroscopic and microscopic ways of calculating electric fields. And in the polarized case, how did they do that? Well, there are these charges every delta z, and their ratio is giving us the charge density of lambda coulombs per meter. But we can maintain that charge density by halving delta z, as well as placing half the charge over there, right? So we increase the number of charges while decreasing both delta z and the amount of charge by factors of two, then still maintain the same charge density. And if we keep doing this, there's after a while, there is no more distinct charges. There is just a smear of charge. Now our lambda coulombs per meter is really describing a continuum of charge distribution. But in real life, of course, this doesn't happen because charge is, as you well know, quantized. It is charges with smallest, what's the smallest charge that we have? Proton or an electron, if we don't go into more esoteric stuff like quarks, right? Natural building blocks that we work with are protons and electrons. And then there are neutrons, which don't have any charge, but we put them together, or we did it, the nature did it for us, and they become the atoms and molecules and so forth. Inside neutrons and protons, physicists say that there are these particles called quarks. Those quarks have fractional charges, 1/3 and 2/3 of the charge of an electron. But that's a detail because those quarks are never observed by themselves. They are always combined into protons or neutrons or some other things called mesons. They are never on their own, so we never observe any charge that is less than the charge of an electron. So this polarization is just therefore a mathematical convenience, but it's a good one because oftentimes we deal with situations where there are so many charges that we might as well not deal with the nitty-gritty structure of the microscopic electric field, but more smoothly varying structure of the macroscopic electric field. So there is a zero field here, but as you are approaching this guy, the field blows up to infinity, okay? So then you can say, what's the average value of zero and infinity? It's still infinity. That's why the polarized equation gives you infinity over and where was the polarized equation? The polarized equation was when we took our summation, infinite summation, and recognized that it looks like it can be turned into an integral with the usual interpretation of delta z now as an infinitesimal, okay? And then you integrate this equation and get this very simple result, lambda over 2 pi epsilon r as opposed to q divided by 4 pi epsilon at r squared, that's coming from a single Coulomb field. Any questions here? Now, somebody was asking at the end of the lecture some of the details of this calculation. Z term, which is present in the first line, cancels out, right? Most of you saw that, and it cancels out because when we take the Coulomb field contributions coming from individual charges that are symmetrically disposed, those Z contributions cancel out. That's why the Z contribution that is sitting there in the first line disappears in the second line. And then and the rest is, there is a 2/3 of this quantity, and that comes from the magnitude cubed of this vector expression, okay? And then you square the individual quantities, and so while you have r squared and the square of this quantity goes there, so you need a 3/2, okay? Hopefully you can work out all those details. And at the very end, there is an integration to be done, and that's not an easy integration, but it works out to be an easy answer, 2/r squared. And you can look this up Nowadays you guys use Mathematica, right? What do you guys do for integrals?
Wolfram Alpha.
Wolfram Alpha, exactly. You know, you can always try it on your own, okay? And if you fail, you go to Wolfram Alpha, get the answer, and go back and try it again. And eventually you can sort of show yourself. Sometimes integrals are hard, right? Derivatives are typically easy, integrals are hard. That's just the way things are. Okay, so that's, now, you know, forget about the mathematical details of this problem, focus on the physical picture. I hope that this is illustrating the distinction between what I call microscopic fields and macroscopic fields. Any questions about this? So Coulomb flow by itself is describing the microscopic field, and if there are a few of them, you just add them up, superpose, you don't worry about the distinction, but when there are many, many sources, then you start, this distinction start becoming important. The Maxwell's equations, the way that I have posed and the way we will develop, are going to describe the microscopic fields if we specify all the charges and current densities in terms of their exact locations. But then again, that in many situations will be an overkill. We will want to have a counterpart of those microscopic equations that are macroscopic, and that will be done by effectively sort of like smoothing both the sources, the way rho's and j's are distributed, as well as the corresponding e's, and that smoothing is an averaging over space, basically. Okay? So in that sense, I'm going to claim that this particular result should be viewed as this particular result averaged over scales of a few interparticle separations. And this kind of averaging over a small domain relates to a certain operation that was studied in ECE 210. And what is that operation? How do we smooth things? Convolution does that for you, right? What does convolution do? It takes one function and adds up neighboring values according to some recipe. If what you're convolving is a boxcar, then you're going to have a boxcar convolution. So something like that is the link between the macroscopic and the microscopic results here. Any questions? Now, all that maybe complicated math can be bypassed if your objective is to go to the macroscopic solution rather than the microscopic solution by using Gauss's law and these Gaussian pillbox ideas. So let's now get the very same result in a much easier way. Using Gauss's law instead of Coulomb's law, in the way I will illustrate, requires the results to obtain to have some degree of symmetry that makes the problem easy to deal with, okay? If the charge distribution gives rise to some sort of a symmetric electric field distribution, then you can apply this. If the symmetry is lacking, then you don't attempt to use that. Okay? In this case, the problem is looking once again a line that has been charged with lambda coulombs per meter extending from minus infinity to infinity, and coming up with the macroscopic electric field emanating from that using the Gauss's law. Okay? And for that, you say, you momentarily think of Coulomb's law. You say, what if I were to attack this equation, this problem, Coulomb's law? You immediately see that there's going to be cancellations, and the field is going to be purely radial perpendicular to the z-axis, and there is no preferred direction on the xy plane, so the field should therefore be also have the same strength pointing in all directions. So there is a symmetry. You immediately see the symmetry and then say, hey, I'm going to exploit this symmetry with a Gaussian pillbox. This is something that you have seen in your physics classes quite a bit, so this is not a new idea. Basically, you define a surface that is the surface of a cylinder embracing the z-axis. It's going to have caps and a rectangular wrapped area, surface area, two caps and a rectangle. But the caps are not going to matter because the electric field, due to the symmetry that you observe, is going perpendicular to the z-axis. Okay, therefore, a electric field dot ds that is calculated on those caps is going to give you the zero because dot ds is pointing perpendicular to those cap areas, and the electric field is perpendicular to that, so that dot product goes to zero. So the only contribution is coming from the rectangular wrapped surface. So here we go. And this D is our shorthand for electric field times epsilon naught. Okay? So that's, we're going to implement this equation. This looks like calculus, but it's just algebra because of the symmetry. Okay? So for D, we say epsilon naught times E sub r times a unit vector that is pointing perpendicular to the z-axis, but the very same unit vector is also involved with the area increment here, and therefore those unit vectors multiply one another into unity that disappears from the picture. So therefore, epsilon naught E sub r, then the total area of that rectangular wrapped surface, and that is going to be its length, L times 2 pi r. Okay, so now we evaluate the flux on the one side. On the other side is the total charge enclosed, and that is simply the charge density in coulombs per meter times how long is our cylinder. Our cylinder is L long, so this is the equality. And we are almost done. These things cancel out, and then we solve for E sub r, lambda divided 2 pi epsilon naught r, the same result that we obtained previously. But the pulverized version, the macroscopic version, okay? It's only in the macroscopic version I can sort of say, on that surface, the electric field is going to be uniform everywhere. Because in the microscopic one, depending on the details, it's not the same. But you can reach the macroscopic one directly like this. And then multiplying the scalar result with the unit vector, you get the same result that we've seen before. Any questions here? All right. So if you are after macroscopic fields, then Gauss's law is fine. It's a good way of approaching the problem if, at the same time, we have symmetries. Of course, Gauss's law is not as complete as Coulomb's law, is it? Coulomb's law gives you the full specification. Whatever the charge distribution, it is the recipe for adding. You guys are looking as if this is something wrong? No, this is it. This is the next lecture. This is today's lecture. All right, so we're jumping today's lecture. In sort of like going from specific recipe for calculating fields everywhere in space, we have done an integration over certain volume. So we have lost something, okay? What we have lost is not an important loss for symmetric problem. That's why we can solve the symmetric problem just using the Gaussian pillbox. But for more complicated situations, we need to make up for that loss information in the long run, and that is going to be the second constraint that comes. That's going to be the equation that says curl of electric field is equal to zero. That is going to come eventually. Okay? That's in the static situation. That itself, in dynamic situation, goes into the curl of electric field is equal to minus dB dt. And that is, of course, Faraday's law. Eventually we'll see. All right, but anyway, sticking with symmetric problems, let's go from a distribution of charge on a line, which was the previous problem, to distribution of charge on a surface. Okay? Let's again talk about the charge density, but now in terms of coulombs per meter square. Let's imagine a charged surface that is uniformly charged surface and ask ourselves what is going to be the electric field due to this distribution. By the way, our previous conclusion was for an infinitely long line current, right? And that infinity was important. It simplified the problem. But also its results can be utilized if you have a line current, line charge distribution that is not infinite but long, okay? If you are next to some, if you have a wire like this that is charged, okay, and then you're very close, the result that we obtain is going to be fine as long as you're not close to one of the edges. And then if you are very far away from this line, then you might as well forget about that entire result and replace it with, say, single point, exactly. Then far away it's going to be just like Coulomb's. Then you can collapse the entire lambda times L into a point charge and look at that. In that sense, if we work out here a problem for an infinitely large charge sheet, okay, that will serve us also for finitely sized charge sheets in the same sense. Okay, so these are, in some sense, important problems. Okay. All right, so how do we deal with this problem? Well, we have some surface charge density rho sub s that's measured in coulombs per meter square. And let's think of it as a positive quantity. Then intuitively, we know that there will be electric fields pointing out from each of those patches on that surface in both directions. Okay? In fact, we can in our mind, sort of like exercise Coulomb fields coming from various places, and think about their superpositions. Clearly, there's going to be cancellations in two directions, and the entire field is going to be pointing in which direction?
X
direction, okay? And you also feel that the results should be symmetric on the positive X side, minus X side, but sort of like anti-symmetric in some sense. The electric field should be pointing in opposite direction, that's the anti. So then you talk about an E sub X function, that E sub X function should flip sign at the origin. It should be an odd function rather than an even function. There is a symmetry, but an odd symmetry. That's what you're looking for. All right, with all that preliminaries, you select a Gaussian pillbox that's sort of shaped differently this time. I still took it to be a cylinder, but this time the caps do matter, and the rectangular wraps portion doesn't matter, because there the dot product is going to give rise to zero. And I just write down the flux and the contained charge, and then I'm done. Okay, so that's quite easy. This guy is simply E sub naught times E sub x times A. A is the area of that cap, and that contributes to the guy on the positive x side. And then I pick another location on the other side. See, I take advantage of the symmetry of the field, and I create a symmetrical pillbox. My pillbox is also symmetrical. I should be careful in doing that. And I'm going to have a second contribution coming from the second cap. Why do I have a minus sign here? Because of the dot product. Because my E sub x is pointing in, as an entity whose value I don't know, it is pointing in x direction. So I have an E, which is E sub x, x hat, dotting a ds, and that ds is pointing in negative direction, because the rule is that all those surface increments point out of the volume, rather the other way around. Okay? So because of that disagreement between the vector directions, there is a minus sign. Instead of add, we subtract. And I have epsilon naught E sub x evaluated at minus x times the area equals charge density times area. Areas cancel out, and now I say E x of minus x is equal to the negative E sub x because of the oddness that we talked about. And that sort of says, forget about the second part, but double up the first part. That's what that amounts to. Okay, cancel A's and solve for E sub x, rho sub s divided by 2 epsilon. Okay, this is the macroscopic field, and instead of doing lots of integrations, two-dimensional integration, there we get it, all right? You minimize calculus by taking advantage of symmetries. So seeing symmetries and taking advantage of them always reduces the math if those symmetries are there. Very important. The most modern approaches in physics really focus on recognizing the symmetries that exist in physical problems and taking advantage of that. Equally well applies for engineering problems. Any questions? So we are basically done. Graphically, we can show our E sub x as shown here. And interestingly, actually, we have lost all the spatial dependence. This electric field is not sensitive to how far you are away from this surface, okay? Of course, microscopically, things are going to be very different. Microscopically, you're traveling from the positive side through the sheet. Who knows what you will see? You may bump into a distinct charge and go to infinity. You can pass through zeros, the nulls, etc., all those things. But even macroscopically, there is something weird. There is a jump, okay? That jump is going to become important. Later on, it's going to become one of our boundary conditions. When we do boundary conditions problems, you're going to recognize that electric field can suddenly change, but it can suddenly change if and only if there is a surface charge. Maxwell's equations will be accompanied by Maxwell's boundary condition equations. And you must have seen this little bit in perhaps physics 212. And one of the boundary conditions equations is going to be related to what we are seeing here. Any questions? Okay, there is a unit step function, and there is the signal function defined in ECE 210. We can write this equation in terms of the signal function, as shown there. Any questions? All right. So jump associated with surface charge density. Now we're going to go to the next step. Now we're going to have, instead of rho sub s measured in coulombs per meter square, we're going to have a rho with no subscript. That's our notation for charge density that is continuous in 3D. This is coulombs per meter cube. And we are going to say, what is the electric field that is produced by an infinite slab of such uniform charge distribution? Okay? You might say, is this realistic or is this just mathematical? At this point, it's just mathematical. But if you consider two such slabs containing positive and negative charge densities side by side, it then models something that is seen in real life. PN junctions of diodes are of that type. Okay, anybody who has taken 340 already in this class? Anybody taking 340 this summer? Okay, all right, so you're going to be doing PN junctions. And in PN junctions, you're going to have these materials side by side that have a positive and negative charge densities. The fields produced by any size slab can be worked out the way we are introducing here. All right, so the results that we'll see here will be relevant in that sense. Again, we're going to use pillbox because, again, we see some sort of a symmetry here. All right, and we also realize that if we were in the middle, exactly at the center of this slab, there should be zero electric field because there's going to be equal amount of electric field coming from one side as electric field coming from the other side, and the symmetry is going to therefore give rise to the zero at the center. So in this case, actually after you are done, the profile that you see is what you see there. There is no jump. There is no jump because there is no surface charge density. It is just a good old volumetric charge density, something that is more realistic than just a surface charge density. Okay? So and it gives rise no jump. How do we deal with the problem? Well, we exploit the symmetry together with the Gauss's law. This time, it's written pretty much along the same lines, except that as the previous problem, but now in computing the right-hand side, which is the charge enclosed, it's not simply area times surface charge density. This time it's the volume involved times the volumetric charge density. That's the only difference from the previous problem. So we go rho times the cap area A times the length of that pillbox. And that's why we have 2x for the length, A for the area, times the charge density that gives the total enclosed charge, Q sub B. And we have a minus sign for the very same reason that we have discussed last time around. And E sub x of minus x can be replaced with the positive E sub x of plus x, which means that forget about this and double this. It's the same story there. Okay? And we get this result. E sub x is rho x divided by epsilon naught. But this is true only as long as you are still confined inside this charge distribution. If your pillbox extends beyond the end of that slab, then there is going to be no more increase of the enclosed charge density. And then this x here should be replaced by W divided by 2. So you solve this problem in two steps. First, for all those x's that are inside the slab, and then for all those x's outside the slab. And once you are outside the slab, there is no longer x dependence of your electric field. And that is why this type of a profile is obtained. As long as you are within the slab, there is an x dependence such that you go through zero. But once you're outside, you have constant values, just like in the case, in the previous case. In the previous case, we have constant values, equal and opposite constant values on both sides for E sub x. And we are also getting that eventually, all right, in this portion and in this portion. But in between, there is a ramp. Any questions about this? So basically, if you were just to collapse all these charges into one surface, you would be collapsing, obviously, this profile into something that would look like a signal function. That's just there. All right, these are straightforward stuff. You've seen this before in one way or another in your physics courses. And graphically, these problems are best treated graphically, although I am painfully writing down the results here step by step. You should be able to do that as well. For the middle section, for x between plus and minus w over 2, I have an x-dependent electric field pointing in x direction, so that when x is positive, it's positive pointing in this direction, negative, it's pointing in the opposite direction, and the rest. Any questions? So we have done now three problems that each contain some charge density, line charge density, surface charge density, and finally, in this case, volumetric charge density. There is no jump in the volumetric charge density. Line charge density is some sort of a singular situation where there is an infinity right at the source itself. And the case of a surface charge density, it doesn't have a singularity, but there is a jump, which is going to work very important. Okay? So all these things are to be kept in mind. These results are perhaps more important than the procedure that we have applied. Why? Because now we have a collection of results. We have a collection of results that we can reuse. In ECE210, we had Laplace transform tables, or Fourier transform tables, right? Then we use those things with shifts and all that. We can do sort of similar sort of stuff also with some of these static problems. These are now building blocks, okay? More complicated charge distributions can be built from these guys, and then we superpose these with appropriate shifts. Any questions? All right, so let's just give some examples of that type of approach. All right, so this is a Laplace transform table like that. Circle it and use it. Here we go. Now, instead of a single surface charge density, we have two surface charge densities. And in this case, what do I have? I have symmetrically disposed, I have rho sub s and negative rho sub s, equal and opposite surface charge densities. This is going to generate fields that are pointing in this direction, an arrow in this direction, on this side, an arrow in this direction. But because this is a negative source, it's going to behave the same way, but with the opposite. Arrows are going to be pointing in the opposite direction. This time, electric fields are going to be coming towards, okay? And if the magnitudes of these two charge densities are the same, then the x-directed field coming from the first one, as well as x-directed field that is going into the second one, because the second one is negative, are going to be vectors of equal magnitude and direction. They will just add. It will double up. Okay, we will have a doubling of the field due to the positive one in between these two guys. And what's going to happen outside? Outside, there is going to be cancellations. Exactly. Because of the distance independence of these fields associated with surface charges, it doesn't matter how far you are. Okay, the field that is produced by this guy and the field produced by this guy in this region are going to be equal and opposite. They're going to cancel out. So we're going to have an E sub x that just looks like a rectangle function squeezed in between the two charge sheets. Those equal and opposite charge sheets are exactly what you get in a capacitor. In a parallel plate capacitor, you're going to have an equal and opposite charge sort of like sitting on the surfaces of conductors. And in between them, there is going to be this electric field. And that electric field is obtained by doubling the electric field that we had for a single sheet that is coming from the first page. Okay? So that our equation, relevant equation, was surface charge density divided by 2 epsilon naught. Okay? It gets doubled up because of the effect of the negative charge density. So we have then rho sub s representing the charge density on the positively charged plate of the capacitor. You forget about the other one because of the doubling. It automatically takes care of it. Rho sub s divided by epsilon naught becomes the electric field that you have, pointing from the positive plate to the negative plate of a capacitor. Okay? So E is equal to rho sub s epsilon. Or you can take that epsilon naught from the bottom and multiply it with E and call it D is simply rho sub s. D is simply rho sub s. That's the capacitor problem. Any questions? Yeah.
Since you have the positive plate and charge, you're saying that the outside of the.
So the situation is like this. Maybe I should just. This is the positive rho sub s, and this is the negative one. Okay, and electric fields are pointing equal and opposite from the first one. Okay. And if this was positive, that would have been also true. But since this is negative, I have to switch around the arrows, okay? And once I do that, okay, of course, this guy is not only valid here, but it is also valid here, but it's also valid there. It is independent of distance. Everywhere, the same field exists. So here, clearly then, when this contribution and this contribution happen, we have the doubling situation that we are talking about. And then also, this guy is also applicable here, and here is the cancellation. So no field outside the two sheets, and inside it's the double sheet. Okay, so that's what it is. Okay, so a little bit more complicated example is the next one. And this next example takes two slabs and superposes the fields of two slabs. Okay, moments ago we have looked at a single slab. Let's review that. That was in our Laplace transform table, but graphically it was this. We have this characteristic, constant rise constant situation, and you go through zero crossing at exactly the halfway point, midpoint of the slab, assuming there is no charge anywhere in the universe, okay? But there are other charges elsewhere in the universe, then you have to superpose them on top of this one, okay? One such example is, of course, the example that I was just about to do, okay? Now, we have not only the positive slab, we have another slab that is negative sitting right next to it, okay? And then the total field in all over the universe is the superpositions of the fields that are individually coming from these two slabs, okay? I am, in this example, making some assumptions. Perhaps the widths of these two slabs are not the same. But then, perhaps the charge density of them in absolute value are not the same. But I will assume that the total amount of positive charge contained on the positive side and the total amount of negative charge contained in the negative side in absolute value are equal per unit area. Since these slabs are infinitely long, I have to make that clause. But basically, this is a charge-neutral universe in this picture, all right? By the way, our universe is more or less charge-neutral. Okay, basically this is something for the cosmologists, but we have equal amounts of positive and negatives in our universe, so therefore we are charge neutral. But of course, well, in every atom, unless it's ionized, you see that, okay? And there is no exact proof for this, but there are very strong arguments for having our universe charge-free. So anyway, so wherever there are pluses, there's always going to be some compensating minuses somewhere. And in this example now, we have put the compensating minuses right next to the pluses. And this is the exact situation that 340 students are seeing. This is the junction problem. So how do you solve this? Okay, there's going to be a homework problem that's just like this, but instead of two slabs, it's a little bit more complicated, three slabs. What we're going to have is take the field that is produced by the first one, shift it, okay, take the second one, shift it also, and add them. That's it. So that way, the operations are very simple, similar to what you have been seeing in ECE 210. There was a lot of shift, scale, and add, okay? So now, here's the full picture. It's best done graphically, and when you're doing this homework problem yourself, please do it graphically and then work out the equations. It's just easier to see. Okay. So first, let's go first to the green line. The green line is the field that is produced by the positive slab, and it is nothing like other than a shifted version of the graph from the table that we had in the previous page. Okay. In particular, I am zero crossing with my electric field that is due to this guy exactly at the location that corresponds to the halfway point of that particular slab, okay? The negative slab likewise has a shifted, but this time also flipped around contribution because of its negative. We have to flip it around, just like we had to flip around the arrow direction, okay? You either flip around the arrow directions or you keep the arrow directions the same. You change the magnitude of the field component, E sub X. It's just like in circuit diagrams, you either change the arrow of the current arrow or you keep the current arrow the same, but you algebraically change the sign of the current variable. It's similar. Okay? So then we flip it around and again we go through zero. So we have to now add these two lines. And when we add these two lines, okay, you see there is positive stuff here, but there is negative stuff there. And they are exactly the same, okay? And the reason why they are exactly the same even though the W's may be different, the rows are also different, okay? They are different in such a way that the saturated field values are equal. In this case, this is going to be exactly canceled by this guy, okay? And when you do the addition, you get this type of field distribution, zero field outside. So the electric field is non-zero in the sort of this sandwiched depletion region, p-n junction region, the junction region, as you will see in 340. When you see this talk. Any questions? Okay. Yes. So at this point, I have a negative value and another negative value, and they add. They become even deeper negative values. That's exactly what happens. You add it sort of like point, just go point by point. Okay? You can see that that's going to happen. And then you can also see that right here, there is going to be cancellation because these two are equal and opposite. That's why you go back to zero. And the same thing can be claimed exactly at this location. That's what it works out. Okay? And that is with exactly uniform charge distribution, constant charge distribution in those two regions. In a p-n junction, that charge distribution can be slightly varying, a little bit rounded, and therefore you might have an electric field distribution that is zero and then is a little bit rounded and comes back. Okay? So it will depend on the actual charge distribution. All right, so that's that. So now I have effectively just exemplified two problems of where we can use our previous results. And you will be doing a lot of this in your homework problems. So you're not supposed to go and solve every problem from scratch. You make use of problems that have already been solved. And now, as the exam is coming up, you will be compiling cheat sheets, and you put into your cheat sheets whatever you find useful as the beginning points in your homework problems. Whatever helps you in the homework problem is going to help you in an exam problem. So start compiling cheat sheets. All these equations would go into your cheat sheet. Charge density. So we talked about charge density, and we have several flavors of them, right? Rho sub s is the surface charge density. There is lambda, which is the line charge density. In this is measured in coulombs per meter. This is coulombs per meter squared. And then there is the rho. That is the generic charge density. When we say charge density, unless we say something else, we mean this one. And that is coulombs per meter cubed. And this is the rho that shows up generically in Maxwell's equations. Okay. And then there is the point charges, okay? And they all can be sort of like referred to this generic one through the use of delta functions. And that is something that I pointed out at the beginning in our first lecture. But here is the same discussion with a little bit of pictures here. So we have a point charge at the origin. Then we can think of a charge density rho that is written in terms of Q, that is the exact point charge, times delta functions indicating the position, okay? If instead of the origin, the charge was at x0, y0, z0, sitting somewhere there, so we want then a charge density of infinity at that location and zero everywhere else. And that can be provided for you by the delta function. Delta function, pedestrianly speaking, is infinity where it is active and zero everywhere else. Although mathematicians don't like to see it that way, we engineers often view it that way. And if we know what we're talking about, usually we don't fall into traps because of that imprecise language, okay? So here we go. Just thinking about that, I say my charge density associated with a charge sitting at x0, y0, z0 is this rho, okay? And which then tells us that for things to work out correct unit-wise, each delta function has a unit. What is the unit of each delta function? Did I tell you the other day when I went through this discussion briefly? Maybe not, but it's in your 210 book. Each delta function assumes the unit of?
1/meter.
No, it's not. 1/meter, it assumes the inverse of its argument, okay? If you have a delta of t, its argument is measured in seconds, its unit is 1/seconds. If you have delta of x, its argument is measured in meters, and then it assumes inversion. Where does that come from? It comes from this guy. We know that if we integrate from minus infinity to infinity, delta of t dt, we get 1. That area 1 is unitless. If that area 1 is unitless, we look at the other side, the increment here has a unit of seconds, so this better has 1 over seconds. Okay, so therefore, remember this forever. Every delta function has the unit of the inverse of its argument. Okay, and that is why when you integrate this thing, which is this by itself has the right units of coulombs per meter cube, but when you integrate it over a volume, it just becomes coulombs. Any questions? So this is something that we will be using. And sometimes we will just refer to this triple delta function product as a single delta function, but instead of x, y, z, we will have r minus r naught. Okay? That simply means what you see over there. It simply means triple delta product. Okay, and in a volume integral, each one of those single delta function in x, y, and z can be treated as one dimensional integration because we have the product rule applying. Any questions? What about the surface charge density? How do we relate the surface charge density to a volumetric charge density? Here's an example. We have a surface at x equals x naught with a certain surface charge density rho sub s that may depend on x and y. You turn that into a volumetric charge density by simply multiplying it with a delta function that is displacing x by x naught. Okay? And unit wise, that's again correct because surface charge density is coulombs per meter square. That single delta function multiplying is per meter, so the whole thing is coulombs per meter cube. Any questions? Okay, so I have one final example. So we lost some time during the first two lectures and now we're gaining time. My last example here is a flux example. Most of the time we use Gauss's law by calculating fluxes over closed surfaces, but once in a while you will see exercise problems where you will do a flux integral over a different surface. In this is such an example, okay? In this example I have two charges. Here is the field, and clearly I have a positive charge here and a negative charge there. They are together constituting a dipole, and here's the field, okay? In this problem, we are asking to calculate the flux of the electric field on this surface. We can, if this is the z-axis, this can be xy surface, or z equals zero surface, xy surface. I want to calculate the flux there, and it can be done, of course, in two ways. If I say I want to calculate the flux, somebody has to ask me what's the reference direction. Okay, when I calculate fluxes over surface, there is always a direction associated with ds. And by convention, we always take ds pointing outside, out of the volume in closed flux calculations. In this case, it's not a closed flux calculation, so we have to define it. Okay, what did I say here? I think in this case, determine the electric flux integral on the xy surface E dot ds across the entire xy plane using ds pointing negative minus z hat direction. Okay, so we're going to imagine a unit vector pointing in that direction and then calculate the flux over that entire surface. Now, there are two ways of doing this problem. Okay, we can use Coulomb's law to exactly write down the electric field everywhere in space that is pictured here. That is nothing other than the sum of two displaced coulombs, one associated with positive, one associated with negative. Okay? Then we can evaluate that electric field at z equals zero and multiply it with dx dy times the unit vector minus z and do a long integral, big integral. And that calculation is sort of started and concluded at the end of the problem. But in an exam, you shouldn't do it that way. You should use some symmetry arguments and hopefully work out the problem as follows. Okay, so over a closed surface, the integral surface integral of d, which is epsilon times e, is the enclosed charge. Okay, or the surface integral over a closed surface of e is enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. Okay. Now, we have such a charge sitting right here. okay? We can put an imaginary surface surrounding it. One, it's a sort of a rectangular box, infinite in xy extent, but it has one surface on the surface of interest, our xy surface, which is some distance away. And then consider the complementary surface. Okay, although this is no longer a spherical closed surface, it is a, it has its symmetries, okay? And we say that there is no reason why I should assume the answer for each of those two parallel surfaces, the flux, is anything other than one half of the total flux. Okay? So instead of q divided by epsilon naught, it is going to be q divided by 2 epsilon naught. That should be the flux going down. Because I define the flux going down, that's the correct value. I don't have to put that minus sign. That is due to the charge on the top. Well, then you can superpose things, right? The charge on the bottom is also generating some flux, but this time the direction is the opposite. But then the direction of the electric field is opposite, but the flux calculation works the same value as the positive one, right? So we add that as well. So we add to Q divided by 2 epsilon coming from the positive charge. Another quantity, Q divided by 2 epsilon naught, that is coming from the minus Q charge, and that is the total result. Now it has been done using symmetry. So we have these two results, top one, middle one, corresponding to the contributions coming from the two different charges that are constituting the dipole. We add them up, and this is the total result. And when you do the lots of math, if you don't believe your instincts, you get the same results. Any questions? So that finishes. So we have a sort of a homework problem in which we want you to figure out what are the charges if the fluxes are given. That's an inverse problem. Okay? You have to use the results of this example as you are setting up the equations that you solve. Okay? So this is an important example. So we are stopping 2 minutes early because we ran out of this material, and we started divergence and curl calculations. We're going to go through now the real review, detailed review of MAT 241. Next lecture. Yes.